we have a basketball program that we all expect to compete for Big Ten and national championships year in and year out.
There's no other way to look at it. It's one of the better jobs in Big Ten.
Final four! I didn't think you got me this good, but it feels good!
First, I need the national championship.
Welcome on in, everybody, to the boardroom. Maddie here alongside Josh, Johnny, and Sam. And we're fighting Illini. Have defeated the Wisconsin Badgers by a final score of 80-67. We move to 16-5, 9-2 in the conference after an absolutely, give me an adjective to describe Kofi. Right now, everyone give me an adjective.
Just dominant.
Dominant, Sam.
Really good.
Really good. That's two words. Is that an adjective? I don't know. Josh, adjective.
Great.
Okay, now I was looking for something a little bit more exciting, like vivacious.
Erotic.
Okay. We have to put the explicit tag on that now. But yeah, after just an absolute explosion of a performance, 37, one off his high score there of 38. Really fun to watch. It's, Robert said it's been, what, now 1,080 days since Illinois has lost to Wisconsin. And we don't play them in the regular season a second time. So barring a tournament or Big Ten tournament appearance, that is going to last indefinitely. So let's get to some quick takes here, and then we will invite our good friend Ken Pomeroy in the second half of the show to chat some college basketball.
Yeah, I mean, what's crazy, we talked about it for a second there, is the amount of days that it's been since we've lost Wisconsin. We didn't beat Wisconsin in our 4 years in college, and actually, I looked it up, there were four graduating classes who went winless against Wisconsin. To now see the 2023 class could potentially not lose a game to Wisconsin. It's like a complete flip of the switch. There's never even been battles. It's just one team dominates, the other team dominates.
Wait, is that right? Four graduating classes?
Yes.
So how many years?
2016, 17, 18, and 19. They all graduated without winning. So like the last time we beat them before Io hit that dagger was in 2012.
So did Trent lose to?
John Gross never beat Wisconsin.
Insane.
And I mean, some of that was their Final Four teams, whatever, but John Gross never beat Wisconsin.
Trent and Monte were 0-4 to start their career against Wisconsin. They're now 4-4. I mean, that's just remarkable to see that turnaround. Yeah, I don't think that you can see.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. Does that stat hold up then? I'm going to just assume Johnny is right on all of these things. I don't question him for a moment, but we still haven't lost them in 1,080 days, so that would have to make sense.
Yeah, the last time we lost them was in the 20, like Iowa's freshman year.
Mm-hmm. Right. I think I remember that game. We lost.
Yeah. But yeah, obviously the big story is Kofi Coburn putting up 37 and 12. He was dominant. He was super efficient. They had no answer for him. But I also just want to talk about Damonte Williams. Like 7 points, 8 rebounds, 5 assists doesn't jump at you, but the defense that he played on Johnny Davis, and Johnny Davis scored 22 points, but going 5-for-19 and really like struggling to just be consistent from the field was a huge reason why we won the game. And you go back to the Northwestern game, which we didn't have a podcast after,
maybe talk about that.
But
he played well there.
Just
well.
Exactly. Like Damonte has really been that fifth-year senior guy that has just people in the fan base sometimes inconsistent about. Dude is just an absolute winner, and that's why Brad tries to play him 37 minutes a game, because you can just trust him, and you can trust him to give Johnny Davis probably maybe his worst game of the season. Yeah. I mean, the dude went 5-for-19, and the 1-3 that he hit was against Grandison, and that was a contested prayer.
Yeah,
so.
And I think that Damonte's defense sort of gives him a little bit of confidence for his offense. I mean, we haven't seen him drive very much in his career, and I can remember like 3 distinct drives getting into the paint today. Like, that's not something that he does very often, and he took it to the rim multiple times, and it's fun to see him because he's aggressive. He's a bulldog down there. I'd love to see him do it a little bit more as well. You know, if guys like Plummer are struggling, or Grandison, who was struggling going into the game, and finally it looks like he got a shot back, I'm all for Damonte going to the hoop.
Yeah, what's interesting about Damonte is if you watch his high school tape, this was pretty similar to the player he was. Then he tears his ACL. Then he's a freshman. He isn't like someone who can generate instant points. So I feel like for 4 years, more or less, he kind of like fell into this role in a sense.
Yeah. no time like your 150th game to decide to start, yeah, you know, driving to the rim here.
And I mean, we, Kofi at 37, Grandison at 14. Thank God Grandison came back, but no one else had more than 7 points. So
no,
it was definitely
7 from DeMonte.
Definitely
seven
needed
from Trent,
every point.
7 from Curbelo. We can talk about him. He only played 11 minutes, but it felt like, you know, from the get-go when he checked in for that first time, just that spark, immediate spark, that insane pass to Kofi that I still don't know how it got there, that amazing pump fake three, it injects something so unique that you cannot, you can quantify it. We're going to talk with Ken. He's the king of quantification, but in a sense, you just can't quantify that type of energy.
Yeah, and I feel like the story of the game is he only played 11 minutes, and it seemed like conditioning might have been an issue, which makes sense. I mean, when he came back from the concussion against Purdue, they were like, he's not conditioned, and then immediately gets COVID. So it might take a few weeks to really see him getting major minutes, but that spark was huge, and we needed him when the offense was sputtering a little bit, and then we really caught our wind in the second half and just kind of pulled away. And one really fun thing to watch this game, too, was just Wisconsin's three-point shooting, 3 for 24. Some of it was just great defense. Some of it was just them having really an off night, whether we're in their head. Maybe the Orange Crush was going wild. But it was great to see brick after brick after brick. Very frustrating to see some offensive rebounds. But I guess when you miss 21 threes, you're going to get a few offensive rebounds.
Wild. We do need to talk about Crush. First, the good, getting out in the winter, in the weather, getting their butts into seats, you know, 80 minutes before game time. It's already full. Thank you, Crush. You were loud and you were proud. It was awesome. The whole Johnny Davis overrated chance in the third minute of the game when he gets to the free throw line. Look, I hate to say it, but he's probably the Big Ten player of the year right now. And, he put up an okay game. He put up 22 points. A lot of them came from the 11 of them came from the free throw, like you said, Johnny, and he was defended really well. But I don't know if that's the strategy that you want to take here, is calling him overrated. I mean, hey, there's a lot of chance that you can use overrated. Maybe at least use that for Davison or something.
Yeah, I mean, Davison, it was great to see him struggle and him
and the flop one.
Yeah, the flop one.
Oh my god, that injection. Seeing the
wait, actually, I think that was Johnny Davis.
It was Johnny Davis.
Yeah,
but we were
Johnny
like,
I wonder why you would get confused.
Yeah. He's
I did say after the Johnny Davis flop, it's part of their culture.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, we have culture wins.
Culture
they have
flop.
Culture
yeah.
Right? So it was truly heartwarming to see Brad struggle again, and this is not the first time that he struggled against Illinois. He struggled last year, I'm pretty sure, as well. Shockingly, you know, when Trent Frazier guards your guy, you're going to have a tough night offensively. Yet, I don't know, Mr. Naismith, how many years ago did James Naismith die?
I don't know.
Like, he would be out of eligibility.
Like, he's rolling in his grave at the fact that Trent isn't on that list, on that short list.
Oh, the deep boy
exactly.
list.
Exactly.
The deep boy list.
Although, I'll give exactly. Brad Davison credit. He played good defense against Plummer. He really prevented him from getting open threes. And Plummer, again, kind of struggled from three, going, what'd he go, 1 for 6? And not, he's still in a slump. But I guess once you get Grandison out, next job is to get Plummer out of the slump, and then we'll be rolling.
And then we will never miss a three again.
I'm glad that Johnny brought up the Monte defense on Davis, but it was also just Trent's defense on Davison that we've been like stressing to every voter as we've been talking about. Like he deserves to be on that
stressing
list.
Stressing to the voters. We are canvassing. We are getting out. I have been talking to, I've been talking to Bob. I've been talking to all Bob Asmussen, of course. I've been talking to FSU's voters. I've been talking to voters in the Big 12. You got to get your – Josh is laughing at me.
But, Brad Underwood stressed the point, and I think it just was proven tonight. We were able to shut down with our two fifth-year seniors. They're two best players, and when that happens, good things happen. They could be going – they could have an off night, a cold night in Champaign, going 3 for 24, but it has a lot to do with their defense, as well as Orange Crush getting into their heads of all the players. So props to them, as we were just discussing.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to speak too soon because Big Ten tournament, but maybe this is the last time we play Brad Davison. Like, maybe we're finally.
Nah, he has another year.
It's not like some other kid will come along and
Nah, I'm sure he'll find a way to get an exemption for an extra decade.
Although it is funny, him and Trent kind of, they both 5-year players, 5-year starters, really. And they traded, if you remember Davis's freshman year, he used to wear that like shoulder brace. And now full circle, Trent's wearing the shoulder brace. But
they've
had some battles, but I guess now.
Interesting trajectories.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It'll be very interesting to see where both of those guys go next year. I think, like, of course, very high level players in a really good conference of basketball, but their game in terms of size or athleticism or shooting maybe doesn't quite translate to the NBA. And it'll be very interesting to see where those guys go. I have no doubt that they can play. What if they are like teammates next year in like Greece?
Spain, yeah.
Interesting.
That would be fun. But we have to like root for Brad if we, you know, he's with our boy Trent, giving him dimes. Sam's looking at John like,
trying to think about my Spanish basketball allegiances at the moment.
Right.
Well,
where's
obviously,
Mike Dom?
Badalona. That's Andres Feliz and Brandon Paul.
They could join. What else?
Huge game against Indiana coming up.
Right.
We
can look forward to IU as well, our next game.
Two things I want.
Go ahead, Josh.
I was just going to say two things to call up for this game.
Yeah.
Two things that, like, obviously, we won the game, but if there's improvements, it's like what Brad was screaming the entire time, the rebounding. That was like very suspect tonight, as well as our free throw shooting going 9-for-18. That, as Mrs. DeSumo says, make your damn free throws. Mm-hmm. And it's just so frustrating just watching all these opportunities just to take an advantage and not make it so that we don't have to be stressed in the final 5 minutes. It's frustrating, but I mean, I guess we got the job done, so can't really complain that much about it.
Yeah, I mean, we did it against Northwestern, too, where it's like front ends of one and ones that were just missing.
The most frustrating,
Unfortunately, DeMonte, amazing game, did miss those two flagrant free throws. Like, just got to clean a couple of things up, and we can be rolling.
Right, and you mentioned, Johnny, like a lot of those offensive rebounds came off of those missed three-point attempts that just give Wisconsin opportunities at rebounds, hence more missed shots. But you don't expect that when you have Kofi on the court. And maybe this was a taller team, you know, we've been playing more recently. And I felt like a lot of them were just long rebounds going to, like, you know, shorter guys like Johnny Davis. He had like how many? I think he had 5 or 6 offensive rebounds. It felt like
Johnny Davis and Tyler Wall are shorter guys, but they're also like they're taller than who were playing at the 3 and the 4. So like it's just a tough matchup. Also, like, when you shoot a 3-pointer, like the rebound's going to come off in a more like it's not going to come straight down the Kofi, right. But that's still no excuse. You got to start boxing out. I feel like we're playing them so tight on the shot that they're able to follow their shot when we're not like going for when we should be boxing them out. That's just what my quick like non-basketball mind is seeing.
They should probably make the threes. Then we can't give up an offensive
rebound.
That
is true.
Yeah.
Just make it, we can't give up an offensive rebound. I should. Coach, that's genius.
Yeah, it seemed like in the second half, DeMonte in particular was kind of focused on getting those box outs, and he got the one with Wall or with the flagrant, and I mean, he still grabbed 8 rebounds, but you'd like to see a little bit more out of Grandison. You'd like to see a little bit more out of some of your guards, because that's the thing. Io was a really good rebounder for his position, so it's tough sometimes when you're not getting that production out of your guards. But We'll take what we can get, and we'll take a 13-point
absolutely.
Win. It really should have been a 16-point win, but they made that stupid three at the end between that Boo Booey three and the Wisconsin three at
the
end.
Well, that one we didn't. The Boo Booey was the bad beat. The Wisconsin three at the end, we're still covered.
If you had alternate spread minus 16 here.
I was literally going to take it, and then I go, I feel like there's going to be some BS three at the end, and so I didn't take the alternate spread. But as we alluded to, real quick, chatting about IU, I think it's interesting, Johnny, you mentioned that KenPom actually has that listed as a more difficult game going into tonight before Wisconsin is listed as a more difficult game than the Wisconsin game.
Yeah, so even going into tonight, Wisconsin was 26th in KenPom and Indiana was 25th, and that doesn't even take into account road versus home. So Ken was just saying in general they're a better team, and now once his ratings have refreshed, now Wisconsin's 28th, Indiana's still 25th, so definitely a big test. Wisconsin had the good resume, but they won a lot of close games. They had some luck. If you can win this game on the road, that's huge. And I mean, Robert alluded to it too, that if you win this game, it's a no doubt like quadrant one win, but sure. Wisconsin could potentially dribble out of the top 30. Gosh. Probably not likely, but potentially. But Indiana is going to be a top 75 team. So get this win. You're 10-2 going into Purdue. And once you're 10-2, then it's like, okay, all we got to do is go 5-3 or 6-2. And then you're.
You got some favorable matchups. You know, you got a Penn State. You have another. You have a Rutgers on the road, which is not a gimme. You have some winnable games. You have an Iowa. I don't have our schedule memorized, but you've got winnable games for sure.
Yeah, but no,
this is the. I'll go, Sam.
I was just going to say, I'm looking at Indiana's schedule. 4 of their 5 wins on the road. They beat Purdue at home. Lost to Michigan after the Purdue game, but they were probably, I don't know, maybe they were worn out or whatever. But
they were tired.
But
they
last year that was just such a slugfest to overtime and the whole Trent Cash thing in Bloomington. Like, there's just no way we.
Making an easy game.
Let's play guess the spread then.
They're also coming off of a full week of rest.
Rest or rust, though.
Rest or rust.
Let's spend the next 40 minutes
to do
it. Yeah.
I would guess it's pretty close to even.
Yeah. I would say, well, here's the thing. We were favored by 7 points against Wisconsin. I know Kempom
has
argued Indiana's the best team, better team of the two. You know, at least the metrics maybe say so. Yeah, you could be very close to even. It might push to half. One way or half the other, depending on where the sharps think that it is. But if you like big man matchups, Trace Jackson Davis against Kofi Coburn should be an absolute doozy. I wonder at what percentage of the points are going to be scored in the paint from that game on Saturday morning. Should be really interesting. It's going to be a fun matchup, I think. Really good against a rival. I know that's kind of like always controversial to talk about. I'm like, who's our rival? A rival?
Yeah, I mean, historically, they've been a big rival. I mean, I was talking with some of my friends who were in other Big Ten schools. They're like, oh, is Northwestern Illinois' biggest rival? And I was like, we're 67-13 against them in the last 40 years. They're not a rival. But a lot of the teams who were our rivals, like, we were really good in the early 2000s when Indiana wasn't good, when Michigan was really bad, and then in the mid-2000s and 2010s, yeah, we were really bad and those teams were good. So we don't have like an established rival like we did, say, in the 80s when it was Indiana, Iowa, Michigan State. So, but now teams kind of don't like us anymore. And I think that's because we're good. Yeah,
I think that means you're doing something right. You know, how many teams don't like Illinois football? You can really count on less than one hand how many teams don't like Illinois football, and that's probably because we have struggled. But we're not here to talk about Illinois football right now, although we just got a lot of additions to the roster. We're not going to get too down the rabbit hole because we are 9-2 in the Big Ten. We just defeated Wisconsin. We are sitting alone, not tied, not within a half game, but alone atop the Big Ten standings. I mean, that feels good. That feels good to be alone up there. We will look to continue that trend Saturday morning as we take on Indiana in Bloomington. But in the meantime, we will now kick it to a very special guest. Please give it up for Ken Pomeroy. All right, we now welcome to the show Ken Pomeroy of the incredible KenPom.com. If you're a college basketball fan, you of course know Mr. Pomeroy and all of his college basketball metrics. Ken, thank you so much for joining the show. We had a blast with you last year, so we appreciate you coming on this year. My heart is still racing a little bit from the end of that Illinois-Wisconsin basketball game, so if we wouldn't mind starting there, an amazing showdown between the top two teams in the Big Ten. I guess, do you see Illinois and Wisconsin being the top two teams in the Big Ten as we're just past the halfway point of the conference season here? How do you sort of see the rest of the Big Ten slate just kind of panning out, especially after this game here tonight?
Yeah, I mean, projecting forward is in terms of, I guess, team ability. I mean, I think you got to put Purdue in the mix for one of those top two teams. You know, I think you could go Purdue, Illinois, you know, Michigan State. Those three teams seem to be pretty strong. I might even put Indiana ahead of Wisconsin. You know, obviously Wisconsin's record speaks for itself, but, you know, margin of victory does mean something historically when you're trying to project forward, and it's rare for a team to avoid you know, that catching up with them. And so, you know, I think we saw that a little bit with Wisconsin tonight. Obviously, a team that has some flaws, and specifically from, you know, the perimeter. And when they're bad from the perimeter, you know, the offense really struggles.
Yeah, that was tough to watch if you're a Wisconsin fan. They started, I think it was 0 for 13 from three, and I think they ended maybe 3 for 25-ish.
Yeah, like
quick math, that's not so great. So when you start the game 0 for 13 from three, how much of that is shooting luck versus just good defense? How do you balance that?
Yeah, it depends on the team. You know, obviously, the great three-point shooting team is 0 for 13, then that's probably some bad shooting luck. It seemed like Wisconsin was getting some decent looks. You know, one thing Illinois has really done well this year is defend the three-point shot in terms of limiting attempts. So, you know, they did that pretty well against Wisconsin. But, you know, Wisconsin kind of, I think, shot themselves in the foot with just, you know, missing some of those open shots. And then towards the set, you know, in the second half, they forced some up a little bit as they got behind. And that probably contributed to the low percentage as well. But certainly it was pretty ugly in the first half.
Yeah, it really was. And it was fun to watch as Illinois fans, we will admit.
Okay, just you brought up the three-point attempts. And I think that's one confusing aspect I kind of see in when I look at like Illinois' ranking within KenPom.com. And so their three-point attempts, it looks like it's low. And you put for both their offense and their defense, right? The three-point attempts of their total field goals, right? So you have that labeled as an orange box, not a red box. I noticed that. What does that mean to me as I'm looking at your rankings?
So first of all, they take on offense, they take a lot of threes.
Yeah.
Defense, they prevent a lot of threes. And so, yeah. So I don't know what color scheme to use. Like, I know it does confuse people, and I go back and forth on what to do with that as well. Obviously, you know, a lot of the other stats are red and green. Those, you know, there's value judgments you can make on like, you know, shooting percentage or whatever. Like, obviously you want to be higher in that. That's always better. But for 3-point attempts, you know, that's just a stylistic type thing. And so there's really no value judgment placed on that. So it's, you know, one end of the spectrum is orange and the other end of the spectrum is blue. So I apologize to people who are colorblind because it's probably a mess.
Well, we like orange and blue, so we'll go with that color scheme any day.
But yeah, it is interesting though, because you do hear some basketball people say sometimes like 3-point defense, like the percentage isn't a great statistic, but just driving teams off of the 3-point line is
right.
The sign of a good 3-point defense. So I guess in that case, people would say Illinois has a strong 3-point defense.
Yeah, it's really like just it's what you can control, I guess. So I mean, you know, some teams allow a lot of threes, and you know, that's not necessarily a bad 3-point defense. It just depends how you're getting there. You know, if teams are getting a lot of open looks from three, then it's probably a bad 3-point defense. You know, historically, like Syracuse would be the prime example of this, not in recent years, but certainly in the heyday, 10, 15 years ago, they play zone and just force long possessions. And teams, when they did take threes, would take them, you know, often like well off the 3-point line. So they'd be tough shots. They'd give up a lot of 3-point attempts, but teams wouldn't shoot that well against them. So 3-point defense is a tough nut to crack. Like, it's, you know, I know people want like a simple answer on, hey, this team has a good 3-point defense or not. But a lot of times it's hard to figure that out. But the main thing is, you know, when you play Illinois that you're not going to be able to take as many threes as you normally do. And if you're a team that is a good 3-point shooting team, Wisconsin didn't fall into that category. But if you're a team that makes a lot of threes and takes a lot of threes, then, you know, that kind of defense is going to make you pretty uncomfortable. And the other thing they do, by the way, is prevent assists, which, you know, it's kind of indicative of a defensive style too, where they're really not helping off of shooters. I mean, it's all consistent, right? They're not helping off of shooters. You're not going to get many threes. They're going over screens a lot. They're going to force players to drive instead of, you know, set up for a three or pass. And so, you know, that can make teams that kind of style can make teams uncomfortable as well, because they're gonna have to do a lot of one-on-one in order to make shots.
Okay, so the orange box has nothing, like, I shouldn't read in bad, right?
Yeah, not good or bad. It's just a way to highlight things. So an extreme orange color is going to draw your eye to it, and you're going to be like, oh, wow, you know, Illinois' top five in preventing field goal attempts. Or if it's extreme blue, you know, they're going to be on the other end of the spectrum.
Yeah, and Jeff, Josh, another orange and blue one is possession length, which Illinois is an interesting one because they have a long possession length and allow a short possession length, which – intuitively, you would think you want a short possession length because you're doing the 7 seconds or less quick offense. But if you're someone like Illinois who's dumping the ball into Kofi Coburn and then takes a little more time, right? So having a longer possession length, being in the 300s, isn't necessarily a bad thing.
yeah, again, it's just a stylistic type of thing. And yeah, there's plenty of great offenses that that take a lot of time. Like, that's, you know, honestly, typically when you used to look at the top offenses until this year, like, most offenses were like average or below average of possession length. It's kind of changed this year because both Gonzaga and Arizona are great offenses, and they all have, and they are top three in terms of shortest possession length. So you have two like shiny examples now of teams that like to really push it and score effectively. But it's basically a stylistic thing. There's very little correlation to, you know, possession length and offensive efficiency.
Yeah, it's interesting. When Brad Underwood came to Illinois, I feel like all the hype was his 7-second offense. It's kind of been totally different, obviously, with a player by Kofi Coburn, but for good reason. Yeah. How do you evaluate a team like Illinois, who's obviously had a lot of injuries and suspensions at very few times when Coburn and Curbelo have been on the court at the same time? How do you evaluate a team like that when their body of work may not be fully indicative of how they could be at full force?
Yeah, it's obviously tough. And I think the key, this sounds a little silly, but the key is maybe to not like overreact, overanalyze it, overthink it. You know, sometimes you'll see commentators talk about a guy getting hurt and like, oh, you know, this guy was missing for this game and they lost. So, you know, that's why they lost that game. But, you know, you look at the best players, like I think Curbelo is a good example because, you know, Illinois has some depth in the backcourt. And so, you know, missing him might not be as meaningful as, you know, obviously they lost Coburn. Like that would be, you know, pretty fatal blow to, yeah, to who they are. So, so the Curbelo issue is interesting because he's just a, you know, a totally different player than what they have on the court when he's not there. You know, just a freakishly like high possession type of guy, high usage type of guy, you know, borderline efficiency. And so, you know, you could make some cases, at least offensively, that maybe the offense flows a little better when he's off the floor. I mean, even tonight, like, you know, he looked good out there tonight, but when he was on the court, it was like, you know, it was all about Andre Curbelo and, you know, still a little bit about Kofi Coburn, but you know, it's to me, it is pretty challenging to kind of figure out, hey, you know, what lineups are the best, you know, how is the team impacted by losing this guy? I do think people though tend to overreact in the vast majority of cases to kind of personnel changes.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense. You mentioned Purdue earlier. They've got two guys, Trevion Williams and Zach Edey, who are both on your player of the year list. Do you think they're slightly more vulnerable because those two guys aren't playing at the same time? Or do you think that depth and more depth in terms of foul trouble as well helps them?
Yeah, I think it's worked out pretty well for them. You know, it's a challenge getting them both on the court at the same time. They do have kind of like the characteristics that, you know, they both kind of got to play the five. I guess you could, you know, Williams can move over to the four. He has obviously more ball skills offensively. Defensively is kind of the issue. But I think as long as they can get away with it, it works pretty well. I do laugh a little bit at the storyline, you know, how like, oh, you know, what a great guy Trevion Williams is, you know, for coming off the bench and playing a limited role. And I mean, I hear that, but, you know, if Purdue was like a 500 team, Trevion Williams wouldn't have that great attitude. I can tell you that.
Yeah.
As soon as things go south, like, you know, he's going to be grumbling in the locker room. Like, that's just what any player would do, you know? So, so it's worked out well for them. I mean, it's great that they're, you know, having success and, you know, that kind of allows that situation to persist. But both those guys are obviously very good players and different players, but very good players. And so it obviously makes Purdue a very unique situation with what they do at that position.
Kind of on a similar note, another guy we wanted to ask about was AJ Hogard. So he's the second highest assist rate in the country, but he only plays 47% of MSU's minutes. If you're Tom Izzo, would you be playing him more, or is that not necessarily indicative of his value?
Yeah, I mean, the one thing, you know, the issue at Michigan State is that they have, you know, two pretty nice point guards in Hogard and Walker, and they both, you know, have high assist rates, and they're both, like, modestly efficient, and the reason, like, they're not more efficient is that their turnover rates are just through the roof, and that's kind of the issue there is, like, you know, if you just don't look at turnovers, like, you know, those guys do a lot of good things, but there is that turnover issue. And plus Hogard's not really a perimeter threat either. And so, you know, when you get a high turnover guy who's not a perimeter threat, you know, you kind of wonder, it's a little bit easier to defend. I mean, the assist rate's nice and assists are nice. Assists sometimes get a little bit overrated though. Maybe not on a personal level, but certainly on a team level. You know, I feel like people look at that assist total at the end of the game. They're like, you know, this team shares the ball and they're playing the right way and all this stuff. And assist rate is actually another thing that doesn't have much correlation to offense. You know, you can find some teams that don't have a lot of assists that, you know, still really good offensively. Their personality is just a little bit different. And they can score more off the dribble and score more on the drive and one-on-one and things like that. So, I feel, pretty comfortable with Tom Izzo making lineup decisions.
And yeah, I think he kind of gets.
He's been around the block.
Yeah, I think he kind of gets the benefit of the doubt after this many years. I think we can let him make those decisions.
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and there's more like defensively statistics that we can, I guess, go into. One question also to kind of follow up some of the Trevion Williams discussion. How important do you feel are kind of the success of five-man lineups? Like, do you subscribe to you need to have an effective five-man group to be an effective team, or is it just like the overall depth is really more what matters?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. If you look at like five-man lineup statistics, look at the most frequent lineup, and it's usually going to be your starting lineup if you have a consistent one. They don't play that much together, They basically play, the first 5 or 6 minutes of the game until there's a sub, and, maybe the first 5 or 6 minutes of the second half until there's a sub. I mean, maybe, you get some foul trouble, and that limits that number as well. And then, the coach just kind of makes things up, and they don't, you might see that five-man lineup again later in each half, but it's not going to be as frequent. So, I don't know that it's, terribly important to have a particular five-man lineup that that works. The players end up getting – interchange so much that it's probably again, there's definitely an issue of fit, and there's definitely an issue of roster dynamic and who can play with who, but for the most part, if you just look at individual player stats and combine them in a lineup, in a reasonable lineup, you can't have three bigs on the floor or anything like that, but you put them in a reasonable lineup in a comfortable position, just add up their stats, that's probably what they're gonna do as a five-man group.
Got it. Yeah, because I don't know if Evan Mia, he's kind of like a young KenPom. Yeah. He has on his website top 5-man lineups, and Illinois is number one in the country. So obviously we're going to point to that statistic
and
that say,
stat.
Yeah, it's clear that.
I mean, I think it's a good descriptive stat, it's good to know that. And it's an interesting fact. But I don't know that it necessarily gives you any more confidence going forward that obviously Illinois is playing really well, but I don't know if that having that kind of lineup necessarily gives you confidence going forward. They're going to keep playing well as opposed to another team who doesn't have a single dominant lineup like that.
Yeah. And those guys have played 200 possessions together, and the second best team has played 400 possessions together. So that's Gonzaga. So,
200 possessions, is what, three-ish full games basically. So, you think about what you can learn from three games. You can learn something, but there's all sorts of cases of teams doing crazy things in three games that you wouldn't expect and coming back down to earth or regressing in the other direction. So that's where you got to be a little careful about reading too much into that.
Got it. And yeah, I mean, one thing that I love reading on your website is just looking at who your KenPom players of the year are. And then also looking conferences, who are the your all KenPom team. But I wanted to read you this. So in 2018, Brad Underwood had the following guys visit campus in the span of 2 months: Taryn Shannon Jr., Quincy Guerrier, Oscar Shibue, Drew Timmy, EJ Liddell, and Kofi Coburn. Does that kind of blow your mind?
And why didn't we get all of them?
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Only worked that way. Players always know, right? They always know, they're not all going to come to the same school together because they want a little bit of the shine for themselves. Sure. But yeah,
it's a stretch.
A pretty amazing crew there.
It's what's crazy is none of them were top 30 guys. And now, yeah. I guess it was kind of the sweet spot where all of them were in the 40s, 50s range, where they're going to be maybe multi-year players. So now that it's their third year, all these guys are studs. But
yeah,
it's pretty crazy. EJ Liddell and Timmy.
Quincy Guerrier, maybe not. He might be the weak link there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Had to just throw him in there for numbers, but
when he was a freshman, people did like him. People really liked him as a player, and he's a solid guy. But yeah, he hasn't quite lived up to what the other guys have done.
Yeah, and I mean on the topic of your KenPom list, so in the Big Ten, I think there's 5 players, and there's 0 from the Big 12, not even Akbaji. So, But at the same time, you look at your conference ratings and the Big 12 is considered to be better than the Big 10. Does that just speak to the depth of those teams?
Yeah, it's really weird. You know, I feel like the Big Ten is filled with teams where, like, there is a, you know, like one guy, you know, there's like one obvious guy on the team. The Purdue situation's weird. Like, you can, you know, I'm not terribly comfortable with having both Edie and Williams being ranked in the top 10 nationally because they're, you know, they're splitting time. So, like, you know, combined, I think there's certainly, like, you know, if there was some sort of like combined player of the year, we can make them into a single person, you know, they would be ranked pretty high. But yeah, but it seems like, you know, like, you know, you got Johnny Davis out there and E.J. Liddell and Keegan Murray, and they're just, you know, these big time scorers in these teams. Whereas, you know, the Big 12 really doesn't have those kind of guys. You know, it's, you have Agbaji, who's maybe not as big time of a scorer as people necessarily think, but, you know, you have him. And then, you know, the rest of the league is kind of like, for the most part, it's, there's not an obvious guy or a big time scorer on any of those teams.
Yeah, and right now Kofi's not even in your top 10, although I would imagine that would refresh. I mean, I'm guessing that's largely just because of his percentage of minutes played, because he's missed five games between the NIL suspension and then the
He's been in there before, but
He was as high as number two.
If this updates while we're talking, I would imagine tonight's performance would bump him back in there.
Yes. All right, we can clip that right there. Did you say kind of player of the year, Kofi Coburn?
If we get our just right.
Just right.
I am curious, though, and I mean, it's hard to conclude anything in the tournament because it's so chaotic and so crazy, but do you find that, like, having a player who's on the player of the year list is somewhat important to making a deep tournament run, or do you think that it's more about depth, or is it just kind of a mix and match of depending on the team?
Yeah, I mean, the default answer there is I don't think it's important. But, you know, it depends on the player too. Okay, it's like Oscar Tshiebwe is, you know, kind of the front runner right now for player of the year on my site, and I think nationally I'm kind of getting that vibe. And, you know, he's obviously not the kind of guy, you know, he's not like a go-to offensive guy. So I don't necessarily think like I'm any more afraid of Kentucky because they have Oscar Tshiebwe. Now Kentucky has other guys on the team that make them very good, but it's not like, ooh, like Oscar Tshiebwe, he's going to lead them to the title. Like, you just don't, I don't get that type of feeling. It's pretty rare. Like, it seems like just pretty rare for like the type of guy who would make this list to also be on, you know, on a team that goes and wins a national title. Like, you know, most of the time it's, you know, this kind of high efficiency, high usage guy. And that formula seems to work like at a mid-major level, you know, because that's what really mid-majors aren't going to have like three or four like really good players. If they're going to be successful, they're going to have three or four players on the mid-major level, and they're going to have one guy that just breaks out like Steph Curry or whatever. But at the elite level, I feel like if you just have one guy as your go-to guy, like it just becomes easier to defend that team as you get into later stages of the NCAA tournament. And so it's probably better to not have a guy on this list and, you know, have a little bit more of a distributed offense and, you know, more versatile defense and, you know, have three or four or five good players in your lineup as opposed to one great player and three lesser players.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of why Illinois fans are kicking themselves after last year, because Iowa, we had two, Io and Kofi, 6 and 7 on your rankings. Like, you really had some just bona fide studs. I mean, you look at the list, Gonzaga had two guys. They went to the national championship. I mean, Baylor had Jared Butler, but they also had Davion Mitchell, and they had other guys. So,
yeah.
Well, let's talk about the Big Ten's performance. And I know, Johnny, you want to talk about the Big Ten's performance in the tournament last year, because it was, I don't know if you have to use one adjective to describe it, a bummer.
Yeah, I mean, it was super disappointing, and was curious for you if you kind of like bought into the narrative that it showed that the Big Ten wasn't that good, or if it's the tournament is a single elimination tournament and, you know, it's wonky.
It's so my thoughts on this are complicated and not completely sorted out. I keep waiting for somebody like smarter than me to, you know, like Jordan Sperber to come through and just kind of like clarify what's going on, because I feel like the narrative surrounding it is like just far too simple. And so obviously, first of all, there is like the top thing is, yes, it's a single elimination event. There's a lot of like good teams in this event, and you can lose to almost anyone. And so there's a lot of randomness that goes on, and that's one thing. The second thing is the Big Ten was really good last year, but we didn't have a lot of games to judge them by. But they were really good last year. Even if we had more games, you know, we would have found out they were still the best conference in basketball, top to bottom. So that's number two. But there's also this long-term track record of the Big Ten not performing particularly well in the NCAA tournament. And I used to just completely dismiss that as bad luck. But now I've kind of, you know, come around to the fact that maybe, you know, just like in the NBA, you know, teams are built more for the playoffs than the regular season. There's just skills that are more valued in the regular season. It's skill in general is more valued in the playoffs than the regular season, as opposed to like athleticism or size or things like that. You know, versatility is more valued in the playoffs. And I feel like there's some of that going on in the NCAA tournament as well. Like you could certainly pin that on Illinois and the loss to Loyola, you know, where Kofi had to do, yeah, he had to extend himself defensively. And, you know, that's something, by the way, like Wisconsin is like not able to do. So that like made Kofi very comfortable tonight. Yeah. But as you get in the NCAA tournament, he's not going to have those nights where he can just hang out in the paint and guard guys. Like he's going to have to extend himself again. And there's a lot of big teams, Big Ten teams that seem to fall into that category. And so I think there's a little bit of that, but by and large, it's still mostly randomness.
Sure. And I think that's what makes the tournament so much fun is that chaos right there. And we still have 9 Big Ten games left, but we are slowly starting to look forward to the tournament. And we do say this sort of half in jest here, but I mean, does the tournament committee hate Illinois? I mean, we look at last year, you know, Loyola was a top 10 KenPom team and they were an 8 seed. Since your KenPom ratings have come out, go back to 2002, number 8 in KenPom. Illinois is a 4 seed in the tournament. 2003, number 5 in KenPom. Number 4 seed in the tournament. 2004, 13 in KenPom. 5 seed in the tournament. 2006, number 9 in KenPom. 4 in the tournament. And then, of course, last year, number 4 in KenPom. And we play the number 10 KenPom team in the second round. How do you explain that discrepancy over and over and over and over again?
It's clearly a conspiracy.
Thank you. All right. Anyways, well, thanks everyone for joining. I mean, aside from that, which I'm sure that there are numbers to back it up, again, it's just a consistent discrepancy, and I'm sure it's obviously not just Illinois that has that discrepancy, but do you feel like that the committee is evaluating things incorrectly to a certain extent?
Well, I would say that the committee is not, I mean, obviously in 2003, you know.
Sure.
I didn't exist. So, they were heavily dependent on the RPI back then, but even now, like I would say, I would be uncomfortable with the idea of them using my ratings to seed teams or to select teams. You know, it really should be based on wins and losses and, you know, to whatever extent that is a mismatch with my ratings, like you're going to have these discrepancies and, you know, that's been an issue for the team this year, right? Like they've lost some close games to good teams. And so people kind of, you know, from a win-loss perspective, from an accomplishment perspective, like their accomplishment so far, although it's catching up, has not been as good as like their margin of victory type metrics. And, you know, a team like that is just naturally going to get underseeded in the tournament. Now, like I said, things are catching up and stabilizing and like there's, you know, a bunch of games left. So it could very well be that Illinois plays to its level now and its record at the end of the season is going to justify, you know, a 2 or 3 seed or something like that. Yeah. But I don't think the committee in that sense is evaluating things incorrectly. There's some complaints I have about the committee, but it's not for like, you know, undervaluing margin of victory or anything like that.
Sure.
Yeah. And I mean, I think some of the stats we were throwing out, it was one when Illinois was good and that was the early 2000s right. And their metrics just weren't as good as they are now. And I think there might've been some maybe Big Ten bias back in the day when Illinois was finishing second in the Big Ten and getting a 5 seed or something like that. But
it's remarkable.
Nowadays, hopefully they're a little bit better, but I think they could use some of your stats. Just like Wisconsin, for example, is I think top 20 in the country in free throw percentage allowed. And tonight again, Illinois, very poor like free throw performance. So like some of those luck things I feel like are somewhat valuable statistics that end up kind of playing out in the tournament.
Yeah, so I agree. Like, no question. Like, if you want to predict the tournament, you're far better off, like, looking at this kind of stats that are on my site or my ratings or whatever than looking at, if the RPI still exists. It does still exist. But, you know, looking at just wins and losses, like, of course, you're better off with that. But I just don't think it's the committee's job to do that, you know. And I think they should be pretty much loyal to, you know, strength of record type metrics with a few exceptions, you know, teams, you know, in lower conferences, and we've had these cases in recent years. Loyola last year, I think they did a good job with, but, you know, I know you think they're underseeded, but I mean, at least, you know, in past years, like Loyola might not have even been considered to get in the tournament, you know, like 25 years ago. You know, Wichita State, you know, what was that, 5 years ago when they were, got off the not good start in non-conference, really had no good non-conference wins, and then just plowed through the Missouri Valley with crushing win after crushing win. And again, on an RPI type basis, they wouldn't have gotten the tournament, but because they had good margin of victory metrics in their conference, you know, they basically were allowed into the tournament, you know, and they won a couple, two or three games. So, so that's where I would feel more comfortable using margin of victory. But for the most part, I think just like any other sport, just like the NBA, just like the NFL, whatever, like, you know, basically your accomplishments should determine whether you get into the event. And then, you know, we can all recognize when a four seed's underseeded and pick them in our bracket and hopefully, you know, make a little money off it.
Ooh, that's a good segue. I think we were looking for a hot game. Johnny, were you? Did you want to talk about a hot gambling tip? Ken, we really appreciate you having coming on to the show here. We love talking about this, but I know Johnny's looking to make a couple extra bucks here with the Olympics starting up. So I know that you're dying to know.
Yeah, well, we have a couple of non-basketball questions. First one is, yeah, so you're a big curling guy. So we were curious, do you have any just hot tips for us as we head into the Olympics?
Looking to be the degenerate over the next 2 weeks with. With curling, and I would need to know what to pick based not just the color of the pants.
Right, right. Well, here's I'll give you some good value picks on each side, okay?
Okay, perfect.
On the men's side, I think Team Italy is like a 25-1 shot or something like that.
Perfect. Writing this down.
Yeah.
How many units?
Probably
all of them.
Yeah, all you got.
Did you say rent?
Wait, so but wallet. So do you think they're that much better, or is Vegas? I don't know, not on
they didn't,
point.
You're telling me Vegas didn't do their research on Team Italy curling this year.
Yeah, I got Italy at a 3% chance to win. So maybe 25-1 isn't that bad. But it feels like they're a little undervalued. If you can get them to like medal, if you get odds on meddling, I haven't seen this anywhere yet, but if you can get odds on meddling, just hit your wagon to Italy. They're a good little Cinderella story. They've never meddled in curling. So that's a fun one. And then on the women's side, like you can go ahead and pick the US. Like I feel like they're undervalued. The women's side is definitely more like an NCAA basketball tournament. It's just wide open. Anybody could win it. Canada's the favorite for some reason. They're way overvalued, but I have the US is 8% to win. So, you know, if you can get, you know, 15-1 on them, I think I'm seeing them at about that. You know, you're in a little bit of business there, and you know, you can root for the US on top of that. So it's kind of consistent with your own allegiances, which is nice.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's kind of awkward, you know, when like Italy and the U.S. are playing for the gold on the men's side, you got to root for Italy.
Right. Well, I mean, I root where my finances lie when you have that much at stake at that point. If it's that heavy,
of course.
Is there really much difference between the men's and the women's in terms of style?
Not really. I mean, that's what makes curling kind of cool is that, you know, men and women like can pretty much coexist. You know, you can play together. Like, you know, I play in curling leagues, and they're like, you know, 25% women in the leagues, and it's not like you show up and play a women's team and you totally disrespect them. You know, it's like women can play just as well. The only difference is like at the very elite levels, like men can throw, they can throw harder and sweep a little harder. So the best men's teams tend to be better than the best women's teams. Like the best women's team would be like the 25th or 30th best men's team in the world. So, you know, somewhat competitive.
All right. My mind's on Italy really, in America. Yeah. You got it.
And then final question. We know you have a meteorology background. Were you following the storms at all in Champaign, or I guess this whole icy?
We got blanketed in East Central Illinois.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, obviously a lot of people got affected, but, obviously watching the game, they were talking about it, and it seems like a pretty far reaching storm from like, you know, Colorado to, you know, it's going to affect the Northeast as well. So, I wasn't following it super closely. You know, I'm mainly concerned about myself, you know, kind of selfish that way. So the weather here in Utah, you know, is pretty quiet. But I'm envious. I'm envious of crazy weather, you know, especially if you don't have to travel in it. Like, it's pretty cool.
Are you like a storm chaser kind of guy?
I'm not a storm chaser kind of guy. That's a lot of work. I mean, I've never seen the appeal of like driving, you know, 10 to 12 hours to find a tornado. Like, that's never really motivated me.
You're more of an Iowa State Cyclones kind of guy.
I'm more of a just look at it on radar and be like, wow, look at those values. That is crazy.
Yeah, I love it. Awesome. Yeah. Thank you so much, as always, Ken. We really appreciate it. If you're not subscribed to KenPom and you're a college basketball fan, you're making a mistake. It is a fantastic, fantastic way to stay tuned in to college basketball. And Ken seems to like our team, which is kind of a two-for-one there. So, Ken, we really appreciate you joining the show here as always. And thanks so much, everyone, for listening. We'll catch you on the next one. ILL.